So yeah, as you said, I'm a platform security strategist for Adobe. And I do a couple of different things there. Primarily what I do is I look at the security of Adobe products and services and I try to make sure that they go out securely, they are free of software security bugs, and that end users will be appropriately protected. I wrote a tool called Swift Investigator. That tool is probably not of interest to you guys, but the reason why I bring it up is just to let you guys know sort of where I am. I can do software development. I spent 4 years as a software developer early in my career. But what I do today is not software development. The Swift Investigator tool is a side project, so I can keep my skills up. But if you ask me detailed questions about whether we dynamically link or statically link some Microsoft library within the code, I will not be able to tell you, because I didn't actually write the code. My job is to keep an aesthetic distance so that I can look at the code objectively. Not that there would be any problems with my code, but you know, it looks better on paper if I can keep it objective perspective. And as you said, I help with incident response and other things. So, and I've been doing this work in the security community for about 15 years. What I'm going to speak about is, I'm going to start by giving you an overview of Flash Player. The product within Adobe most people know me for working on is Flash Player. And it has sort of an interesting update history. It's where I have the most knowledge and stats. So I'm going to start with that. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about recent security challenges with updates. As a security person, I'm going to sidebar this conversation a little bit to talk about security incidents that are related to software updates. And then I'm going to talk about some of the more modern stuff that we're doing with other Adobe products, like what we're doing with Creative Cloud updaters, what we're doing with ColdFusion updaters and the like, just to sort of show you where we're headed in the future. And then I'll give you guys a few tips if you have to actually advance a software updater within an organization. So to start off, let me just give you some background on Flash Player. Flash Player is an interesting piece of software to update because it's not an application. It's not an independent process running on the machine. Flash Player is a DLL that's loaded by the browser. So that makes a couple of changes in how you approach software updates, right? You can't check to see whether Flash Player is running or not without spidering all the processes and seeing which processes that have loaded that DLL and sort of a harder thing to do. So some of the traditional software update tasks don't apply because we're actually a DLL. So unlike most applications, it's hard to tell if it's in use. There are actually different DLLs for different browsers because we behave differently in different browsers, so there's multiple Flash Player DLLs. And for the most part, end users don't directly know that we're on the machine. We don't show up in their start menu. There's no desktop icon for Flash Player. On the other hand, we are like a traditional app. We still have to register with add remove programs. We still add tasks to the Windows task scheduler for our RLL update. We have to register the DLL with the operating system. We install a control panel icon so that people can control their Flash Player settings. And the Flash Player DLL installs in SQL and Windows, so we have to have administrative privilege to install the DLL. So it's sort of a weird hybrid of application to update. And when it comes to creating an update, we have to do many, many builds because we support Windows 8, we support, we're natively part of Chrome. The Firefox implementation is slightly different because we run out of process and we have a sandbox in place. So Firefox has its own DLL. We run on Mac and Android, which are different operating systems, so we have to have builds for those operating systems. We support 32 and 64 bits. We have to have builds for those operating systems. And then there's SDK builds and debugger builds that we have to be able to ship as well. So for us to go and actually go through the process of distributing an update, we have to create all these different builds. And then those builds go out through a number of different distribution channels. So if it's Chrome, the Flash Player is updated through the Chrome update mechanism. We have many enterprise customers. We have to be able to support update paths such as SMS and Scott. For Windows 8, we're an integrated part of the operating system, so we are updated through Windows Update instead of our native installer. If you're an Android and you still have Flash on your Android phone, then you get through Google Play. Some people go to the website and download it directly, so we have to have standalone installers. We also have an auto-updater, so people get prompted for the updates. So we also, so in addition to doing all the builds, actually distributing it is quite complex as well because we have to go out through all these different distribution channels. And then For a security update, if there's someone who's actively exploiting a vulnerability in Flash Player in the wild that we've never heard about, we have to go from getting the report that it's out there to shipping it to all the customers in 14 days or less. That means we have to get the sample, we have to debug it to find out where the crash is, we have to file the bug, we have to fix the bug, we have to test the bug, we have to incorporate the bug into the shippable branch, we have to test the shippable branch to make sure that it works inside all the installers, we have to get a prompt in array on all those distribution channels, and we have to get it out to customers in 14 days or less. And that's...
where does 14 days come from?
It's just sort of an industry standard that we chose. And that's 14 calendar days, it's not 14 work days. So Saturdays and Sundays count too. But that's sort of the expected turnaround time for getting a software security update out to customers in order to get them protected. And if you're dealing with a web service, and you deal with web services, it's actually 2 to 3 days. So if there's like a vulnerability on Facebook or Office 360 Online or something like that, the expectation is that you can respond to a security update in 2 to 3 days. Most people do it actually same day or within 24 to 48 hours. That's sort of the expectation within the industry in order to tell people that you're protecting customers. So we obviously care about update adoption. We care for a couple reasons. One, we want to minimize the number of people that can get attacked through a security vulnerability. So we want to get everybody's patched as fast as possible so no one gets malware on the machine. And then also from the business side, we want update adoption because we're a development platform. So the sooner we can get all the features out to our customers, the sooner our developer groups can then actually start leveraging those features, the sooner everyone becomes happy, right? And so you look at different ways of improving update adoption, and I thought I'd start with a quick side story that happened shortly before I started. Shortly after I started. So there was a security researcher who had found a vulnerability in Flashware, and it was an impressive vulnerability. It proved definitively that aliens did exist. The security community went wild over. Partially because the vulnerability could work both in FlashPlayer and work both in Firefox and Internet Explorer. So it was a cross-browser bug, because FlashPlayer was consistent between the two. And also because he proved that a specific type of crash was exploitable that people did not think was exploitable before. So in this paper that he wrote, he proved that null pointer dereferences could be an exploitable condition, same as buffer overflows and manager overflows. So he wrote a huge paper on the 20-page paper. He didn't write the actual exploit given to people to this is why white hat guy is a good guy. But he did write the research on it. This is how you do it, this is how we did it, all that. So the paper was 20 pages, it couldn't figure out how to write the exploit in 20 pages. So probably work on an exploit writer. So he reported it to us, we showed the vulnerability, we put it out on all our distribution channels. And then it was sort of sitting there waiting. How long will it be before someone takes this paper and actually tries to implement it in the real world and starts attacking customers? And what are they going to do with it? Software exploits are used in government-to-government attacks. They're used in espionage between companies. Someone was going to use it, and B, they're going to use it to do something interesting. Right. So then it was just sort of waiting. Like a month goes by, and it hasn't been used in a while yet. And then I begin to wonder what's going on, why is it taking so long? But eventually I get this email from one of our program managers, and she's like, did you guys do something to the updaters without telling me? No. Why? She's like, we're getting huge spikes in the number of downloads. Like, we've gone up 10% in the last hour or so, right? And we don't really sure why, right? We published the thing a month ago. We haven't done any new updates since then. So you know, the update curve should have been on its downward waveform. We're like, okay, well, scare us. Let's go look into it. And we looked into it, and we looked at all the refers for where people were downloading the update from. Because they're downloading it from the website, so you can see what the refer was that linked in there to the update. And they were all from World of Warcraft websites. World of Warcraft blogs, all that sort of stuff. And so, I went to World of Warcraft site. He's got this little breaking news panel up in the left-hand corner. I'm like, well, that's interesting. Usually they don't have one of those up there. Let's go see what it says.
And you go and look at it, and what happened was someone finally weaponized a vulnerability. And they weren't using it to attack other governments, they weren't using it to install malware on people's machines to steal their banking credentials. They were using it to steal World of Warcraft accounts. So World of Warcraft guys found out, they posted a warning on the website, hey, hurry up and go update Flash Player, and otherwise you're going to lose your World of Warcraft. And apparently, this is a very good motivation for getting people to update. It's finally becomes real to them. They will drive home from work and update their computer that day if they think their World of Warcraft character is at risk. But it's obviously not the most, you know, you obviously don't want to rely on a sense like this for your update strategy, right? Otherwise, people will eventually just uninstall it. So, we started looking at some of the technical challenges with getting FlashBlade updated, all these different systems. How can we And at the time when I started, if you went and you looked at the distribution of different versions of FlashBlade out in the wild, you get a pie chart that looks like this, right? You're sort of pushing the limits of how many colors you can fit into a pie chart at this point, and or represent in a six-character hexadecimal HTML tag. This is not the sort of chart you want, right? You basically want like a package chart, like current version, version one is fine. You don't want to have all of this. But yeah, if you look at the charts and look at the like curves of update adoptions, it looks pretty. It sort of looks like mountain ranges, you've got plains down here. It makes for a very pretty chart, but not the chart you want to get, right? And part of this was from a couple different reasons. The reason why the charts were like this is we had a lot of different challenges. If you looked at the update range, you get about 25% would update in the first 4 to 6 weeks. 40% would update within about 2 months. Say, it's a 75% you're looking at 3 to 4 months, and then there were 25% of the people who were almost never updated or jump waiting for a year or more to update or something like that. So that wasn't good. If you look at the graph, one of the things that I did is I consolidated all of the different versions because one release would have different version numbers depending on whether it was a Chrome release or an Android release or something like that. And basically what you'd see is, you know, people all start to get updated and then we'd get a new release and then, you know, before we got all those people updated, we'd have another release. Before we got all those people updated, we'd do another release. So we'd never actually get consistent penetration. Now, there's a lot of different reasons for this. Some of this guys get skewed by internet cafes. Internet cafes tend to reset their or they're basically like the actual snapshot. They reset back to the snapshot at the beginning of every day in order to clear off everything that people have put on there during the course of the day. So those would always reset back to whatever version they had and then they would eventually update. So they keep updating every day. Enterprises are always on their own update schedules. They don't like to push anything out that they haven't reviewed. You got end users who defer to them. We have different version numbers for different distributions, which make math weird. And the different distribution methods would have different rates of success. Like pushing something out on Google Play would have a different success rate than the automatic updater, which would have a different success rate than what was going on in enterprises. And then, you know, Murphy's Law and chaos theory is always present on the internet as well. So we had a bunch of challenges with improving it. But the one thing we did know is that the goal for a security update, what we wanted to do with security updates, is get it within 2 months or less. So this is the detections of a vulnerability in 2011. And so what you see here is, this is, like I said, vulnerabilities tend to be used in targeted attacks these days. They're used governments to governments, or rogue group to rogue group. But they tend to be used in very targeted ways. Not mass campaign, it's I want to exploit you and I want to exploit you specifically. So what would happen is they'd be being used by a small group of people early on, and it would sort of spike, and this was roughly when they would figure out that we knew about it, right? And then once they knew the world knew about it, they would stop because they're trying to do everything with cloak and dagger, they don't want to be detected, so they start using it once they know the world knows about it. But eventually the information gets up on the web, and there's the second tier of attackers who are your general malware writers. So the guys who send you the Viagra emails and the penny stock emails, all that sort of spam that you get. And those guys don't care whether or not they get detected. They're not trying to be cloak and dagger or upfront about what they're doing. Because they all live in places where they're never going to be prosecuted. So they don't care anymore who they are. No one's going to attack them anyway. And it takes them about basically 2 months to actually take the exploit that the bright guys who are doing the target attack up here, take what they had, recode it to work with their malware, start distributing some malware. And so this is when it starts to hit general populace as general malware. And this is about a 2 month long. So ideally, you want to be able to stop all of these attacks here by getting your update out on people's platforms right here, somewhere in this range. Because you don't want this to happen. So that was sort of our goal. One of the update distribution methods that we had was content on websites that encourage you to upgrade to the latest version of FlashFlare. This was actually useful. Actually, we got a lot of upgrades this way, because what would happen is our partners like Google or Facebook, if they knew an exploit was out in the wild, and especially if that exploit might target Facebook customers, they would just have a version requirement on their website so that everybody would update and everybody used Facebook would be protected. And that's great, right? Like it's another way of encouraging people to update besides the update prompt you get on your operating system. The problem with that was it trains people to trust links to go update FlashFlare from websites. And so it opens the door for fake FlashFlare updates. And then people that try to ride the wave go, hey, there's a security vulnerability, update Flash. By the way, I've got the update for you right here. Right? Just install this Trojan. It's Flash, trust me. So that was another problem, yeah. Is when you go, you prompt people to go and do a software update, and it's a very popular update, malware wire just creates fake versions that they try to piggyback on. So
They tend to
will take our website content and they will fake our website. So it'll look exactly like our website, except it'll be like Adobe with 3 E's or something like that, right? They do that type of stuff because most end users don't know what domain names. Especially with Akamai domain names and stuff like that. Load balancer get domain names like get3.w.com. No one's gonna know what your domain names mean. So we went and looked at updater improvements. So the first thing we looked at was silent level updaters. Like everybody tends to like Chrome's model of doing a silent level update because you just never have to think about it. Outside of mind, you just start Chrome with updates. But it took a while for a lot of organizations to jump onto that because there were some legal considerations. There are laws in different countries about what sort of modifications you can make to people's computers. They vary from country to country, and some of them are vaguely written because they're written by lawyers, not by computer science people. And so some of them are written so vaguely that setting a cookie on somebody's computer without prompting them could be considered a violation of the law. Because you've written something to their hard disk where they did not explicitly approve to do that. So, a lot of people stood back and there's like a wait and see, like, are they going to use common sense application of this law, or are they going to rewrite it when that happens there? And then you also have to deal with terms of service legal changes. If we make an update to FlashFlare that's a significant change to the user license agreement, we can't silently update you. We have to prompt you to see if you agree to the new license agreement, and then if you agree to the new license agreement, then but we can't change the UI underneath the room sound update. So we had to look at that. So that means that we have two different systems, one that where we do allow the update to prompt you, one where it was silent. You have race conditions with non-silent updates. We wanted to make sure we did update all the different DLLs on the machine. Enterprise controls are very important to a large software vendor. They're unscapable, so now we had enterprise controls to disable silent auto update for people who want to have managed updates. But we also designed it such that if they wanted to piggyback on the silent update system, they can make their own silent update server and just redirect FlashFlare to the silent update server within their environment. And then they could more easily update the end users by taking advantage of the silent system and also have the control of having the updates come from their side where they can make sure that they didn't tell what their data classifier card is. We made it to work both on Windows and Mac. And these things didn't take a lot of beta testing. There are a lot of subtle bugs that can go wrong, and it's hard to debug them because the end user doesn't know what happened because we did it silently. Things just stopped working. So, for instance, when we did silent hello update of the reader, we first shipped the code to end users in October, and then we did a beta test where about 1% of the population of reader could actually opt into it. For reader, it has 98% penetration on the internet, so you're still talking about millions of customers, and you're talking about 1%. And then when we got through all the bugs from those 1%, we activated it in April. Because like in December, you never do an update. And that worked. We were able to do a silent hello updater. We had to go through all the check analysis to make sure the users have controls. So when it shipped, we had to make sure that they chose to be silent hello updates. We couldn't silently hello update the machine without allowing for silent updates. Some users wanted to be notified every time we did an update because they wanted to track all the changes to the machine. So we had to prompt them to install, and also in our control panel, we had to give them choices so they could go change their mind later. We might have other things in there to let you know that both the version numbers of your different DLLs and the ability to do force an update if they were doing that. So we graded those controls. And the way we had to plan it out was FlashBlade is installed on like 98% of the world's machines, right? If they all update at midnight during their stream time, we will kill the internet, right? We cannot update everybody at the exact same time. The cable that runs between here and Africa will start to boil the ocean. So it's like, okay, well, we'll distribute everything out. Just random good times throughout the day, year at 3, year at 4, year at 5, and have them check. But then you run into the problem of, well, what if I pick like 4:15 a.m., right? 4:15 a.m., even night owls can be about 4:15 a.m., right? So then what it has to do is it has to check every hour after that. So if you shut down your computer every day, when you go to bed at night, and you don't open your laptop up until 6 in the morning, we still need to be able to update that machine. So we set a task at 4:15, and then it checks every hour after that, facilitates a response from the server, and then if it says that there's no update, then the updater basically goes to sleep for the rest of the day and quits checking every hour until 4:15 comes around the next day. And then it starts checking every hour until it's responding to the server. And do that way. You had to plan for the fact that your browser may be running and the DLL may be in use. Swapping out a DLL and running applications in the same queue likely cause a crash. So we had to set it up so that there are different DLL names for each version, and we put the new DLL in the system, move the registry pointer to the new DLL. If your application was running under the old DLL, that's fine, it's still there, but new DLL is there for any new processes that start, any new processes from that point forward to load the new DLL. All right, so you had to plan through the fact that your browser may be in use at the time of silent hello update. And we had to make sure that the design worked without prompts, without starting UAC prompt on Windows, right? Because we installed SQL on Windows, and you have to have administrative privileges. You can't, it's not really a silent hello up there if you get a UAC prompt. So we had to, when we first installed the silent hello up there, it would ask you for admin privileges, and register a task under the admin account, and then the task scheduler for the admin account would actually run the silent hello up there, so the user didn't have a UAC prompt. Didn't work for like all these little design details of getting it to work. And we did the same thing for readers, so that they have silent hello up there. And it was great. We launched it March 2012. You know, updated approximately 600 million users in about 48 hours, which is pretty good. That doesn't count Chrome updates and other distribution channels, just the silent hello update channel. So great, we're updating 600 million users in 48 hours, that solves all the graph problems. Except the next problem you run into is you start to have download spikes of about 750 gigabits per second. Right? Because you're trying to update 600 million people in 48 hours, which is like 10 million power. So then you have to solve the bandwidth problem. Because, well, Akamai is more than happy to charge us for 750 gigabits a second. We do have to share the internet with other people. So then we move to doing a differential updater with the goal of reducing wire size by about 75%. Based on some system tools, we didn't want to reinvent the wheel, so we use BSD, DIP, BSD patch, you know, those tools. And you have to, with any differential updater, you have to think through all the different problems, like what if there's more than one version update, and you have to be able to call back to the original full installers because you can't do a DIP on somebody's more than one version update. And so far, it's been very successful. We're still collecting stats. And then for all the people that refuse to use the updater, we've been working with partners. So, like, if you have a Mac and you have Safari, and you get too far out of date, Mac will just tell you, okay, we're just not running flat player again, so you update. Firefox, same thing, if you get too far out of date, and because you turned it off, we'll eventually say, okay, we're just not going to load flat player until you update. Or, if you want to manually update it, take the risk you can, but you have been forewarned that your job's run multiple. So we've been working through a lot of those update problems. And so far it's been successful, it's cleaned up our graphs. But there's another problem going on in the security industry, and this is where I'm going to sort of sidetrack into security challenges. I have a security guy, so I care most about software updates and security aspects. And if you read the press, the new IT thing for attackers is stealing digital code signs. Stealing the keys that you're using to distribute all the updates. Adobe got hit, someone was actually able to steal their certificate. They weren't actually able to steal the key itself, it was a hardware signing module. But what they did is they compromised the build server that talks to the hardware signing module, and then used the build server's account to sign malware on their behalf. When the government got hit, Firms got hit, Bit9, which is a security company, got hit. All of these companies have been hit. If you follow like some of the bigger security stories like Stuxnet, Flame, Dooku, where security vulnerabilities are being used to target nuclear reactors in Israel and stuff like that, those don't involve big code signing certificates. If you like to play Chinese games, this is a whole list of another set of companies that got hit where they're digital. And these are all gaming companies in Asia that got hit. Conspiracy Lab did the story about the group behind this. It was actually one group that was going through stealing all these certificates to do attacks. And it's great, so if you have a valid code signing certificate, then you can install stuff on the software. You bypass all the OS security controls. Right? Because you've got a valid certificate, you're trusted by your sign, you're good. In addition to that, they've been going after certificate authorities. In these two cases, they're going after SSL certificates, not code signing certificates. But a lot of these attackers are agnostic. They just attack and go with whatever they can grab. So in these instances, they're able to grab SSL certificates. And they use the SSL certificate, CA, to generate SSL certificates for Yahoo, Gmail, and all those other things. So they can create a fake website. That would show up as well as self-mention under Google's name or under Yahoo's name. And actually just this week, on Wednesday, as in 2 days ago, Opera listed on their website that somebody had broken into their environment and sold code signing keys. So this was just 48 hours ago that they posted this. There's two interesting things about this that I'm going to bring up. One is that they sold an old code sign certificate. But the other is they also used a software update distribution channel of Opera to ship their malware. So once they got the key, they signed their malware, and they threw it on the software update channel of Opera to push it out to all of their customers. Fortunately for Opera, they had a network admin that was pretty good. It was paying attention to what was going on. They were just shut it down within 36 minutes. But understand, for a large software vendor, 36 minutes is you're still talking about thousands, if not millions, of users. So, like, if you do the math of Adobe updating 600 million in 48 hours, start doing the math for how many people were actually updating per minute, And you can start to get an idea of scale with this. So this is a new thing, right? This is not only are they scaling cosine certificates, but they're also trying to push them out to software updates. They're using the software updaters that you guys build to distribute them out. And one of the interesting aspects that I saw in their code yesterday, and I don't have detailed knowledge of this, I'm just going with what they posted on the website, is the certificate that they stole at Opera was an old cosine certificate. It was one for Opera 12 that didn't expire. But there are two problems. One is that the operating system won't necessarily block you from installing something with an old certificate. You'll get a different warning in Windows. In Mac, you have to actually run a command line to figure out whether it's expired or not. Otherwise, Mac is going to pay attention to cosine certificates, with the exception of gatekeeper certificates. And the other was that they said, above the future, it would be possible to run our own checks on the certificate, download follow updates, conditions of those points by device. So their software distribution channel didn't actually check to see what it was receiving either. They just went and talked to the download server, said, yay, I got an executable from Opera's website, address Opera's website, says, hey, that's us. And I just didn't run it. And so this is an important thing about when you're designing software update models is with Adobe, we actually need to validate the certificate of everything we download before we run it to validate that it's correct and then have it. Not all software updaters do. So if you guys design these things, one of the things I would strongly encourage you guys to do is start thinking about how you can use this defense in depth measure for ensuring that the software updates that you're pulling down were actually the ones from the organization itself. So if you run an organization, store the keys on hardware's sign module, put them in a protected place, and put them on like a wiki page, you know, or store them in Quickforce, you know, readable directory and stuff like that. Like sometimes you hear stories of people uploading their cosine keys to GitHub because they just update the entire application, they update the cosine key along with it. Use separate cosine keys for separate tasks and you design your system for doing updates. This is one of the things that helps protect Flash Player and Reader. The Arcos, when we had outreach and our digital cosine certificate was misused, is that the certificate that we use to update Flash Player is not the certificate that was stolen. If you have an architecture where one cosine certificate rules them all, if you end up becoming one of those companies that was before, that means all of your software has to be reached. So great different cosine certificates for the tasks. That way if someone does break into your organization, it's different. If you're writing the software updater, make sure you check the signatures of the stuff you download. Yes, you should be getting it from this trusted site, but there may be a man in the middle of the attack, there may be someone who takes over the site. So take the time to validate the certificate of what you just downloaded, make sure it looks legit before you run the lesson. Check the timestamp on it, check the revocation, check the validity of the CA, do all those tasks. And if possible, make sure you design your updaters to allow for secure communication channels. The Flash Player checks on to see if there's a new version that does it over SSL. That way, man, you can fly about the location of the update or the version that's available. And if you publish software, harden your repository. Build servers are a common target these days in network breaches. So where you're actually building the code for your updates is a good target. And it's a good target for a couple reasons. One, it's where our source code is. Two, it's going to be cancel our talks to the signed module, so it's signed build once it's done. So as an attacker, if I get that machine, I can either try to use its privileges and perforce to check code in, or I can try to use it as a leverage to sign. So usually when attackers are coming in the networks these days, build servers. Harden them, current network operating system stuff, this is one hour talk, I can't go into all the details. Limited access to build wikis and build environments are the reason why they figured this out for the way they do your wikis. And like, oh, this is enough, you know, because the wikis in a lot of the companies are open, you can go find them and start reading them, find out where the build servers are located by looking at the network patterns. Find out how the distribution channel works by looking at the coders. Try to do security analysis on the entire environment. So that's my soapbox on security about software updates. go back to actually talking about software. So before I side channeled, I talked about the fact that we were updating our updaters. And this got the attention of XKCD, who had a little bit of fun at our expense. If you can't read it, it says, there's an update for Adobe Download Manager. This update will allow you to download new updates to the Adobe Update Downloader. And if you know XKCD and you do the mouse over, there's always an added joke in the mouse over. And the mouse over, they make fun of Java by saying, some pending mandatory software updates require version 21.1.2 of the Oracle Sun Java JDK Update Manager Runtime Environment Meta Updater, which is not available for your software. So it's great that we can go and we can do all these updaters and we can do updates, but at the end of the day, people don't want to know about it, right? They don't want to find out that the World of Warcraft character is at risk. They just want to use their software, be on with their day, they don't have to stop, click update, all that, reboot their machine, all that sort of stuff. Within an organization, maybe it's solving different update needs, right? Developing companies want better update adoption because getting new features faster to customers makes more sense. End users just don't want to deal with it. Enterprises want to be able to control it. It's great that you guys can update me in 48 hours, but I'm going to double check everything you give me because I have a managed environment. So you always have to pay attention to that. And a lot of times the developers who are trying to get the updates out, they mostly just want something that works. And updates can actually be mean different things depending on what you're working on. So at Adobe, we make updaters for all sorts of things. We have server software, we have runtime environments, we have desktop software, we have cloud services. Yeah. Our hand is almost every type of application software pie you can think of, distributed mobile applications, all that sort of stuff. So one of the things that we wanted to improve updates on was Cold Fusion. If you've ever updated a Linux environment, it's like you gotta stop the server, you gotta make a backup of all the files, you gotta copy the files in, restart the server, then you miss a step, so then you gotta shut it down again, and then you gotta go back and figure out what it is, and you gotta restart it. So with Cold Fusion, what we did is we baked updated novel updater into the server. So if you don't know what Cold Fusion is, it's basically Java plus Tomcat plus a platform, a software development SDK, which allows you to quickly make websites with minimal coding knowledge. And because we have we're running a full server platform, we actually have a UI for administering the server. And so we added, you can go in, you can look at the available updates, there are check for updates buttons, there are download buttons, you can actually have the server install it for you. There's a little red thing that shows up in the corner telling you when you're out of date, you can go to the admin panel. One of the features that we added, which I think a lot of people like, is the server can email you when it's out of date, which is kind of convenient. So when you go computer updates in the environment, you can supply an email address and you have to check for updates every 10 days and then email you when there's an update. That's somewhat convenient for people. So they don't have to check RSS feeds or check the website or anything like that. And you can install all the instances, so it handles everything basically with updating the server. And including telling you which one updates you've installed, where the backup directory is, the uninstaller location, all of that. So just because it was a server doesn't mean that we couldn't think about ways to do auto updates for the environment. We didn't let that slow us down, we actually created auto updates for that. One of the ones that, another updater thing that we worked on was Adobe Air. And Adobe Air is a runtime environment that allows you to create desktop applications using ActionScript. So if you're already a Flash developer and you're used to a way to create website content using Flash, you take the same code, same language, make a desktop application. But since all these, we knew all the people that were ActionScript developers were all website developers, we knew they didn't know about a whole lot about doing software updates. That, and all the different things you gotta do in terms of checking the process, shutting down the process, downloading the file, checking the signature on the file, launching the installer, restarting the process, all that sort of stuff. So one of the things that we did with the runtime environment is we exposed our Rhino updaters to their application, so they could use the same updated infrastructure to update the applications they were building on top of that runtime. So if you create a desktop application upon the AR runtime, you could actually leverage our installer. And we would do all the work for you in terms of downloading the file, checking the signature on the file, stopping the process, installing it, restarting it, all of that. So if you're an ActionScript developer and you wanted to use the integrated updaters functionality that came with the runtime environment, this is basically the code that you need to update your application. All you have, you provide a config file, which basically tells us where the updates are, all that. You provide the function which allows us to figure out whether the version is newer or not. We had a default one, but if you have some crazy versioning scheme, you just provide your own function that will tell us whether or not it's updated. It's not here or not. You add a couple of event listeners for different things, like when it's complete, all that sort of stuff, for errors. And then you call check now. So if you're a developer and you're building a desktop application using our runtime, you didn't have to write your own. Write one as part of the runtime. And all you had to do was write basically one class to install our updater and use it. And this was actually fairly successful to prevent people from having to reinvent the wheel. At Adobe, we used to, every like product team had their own updater because, oh, we can't use this other team's updater because we have this one little quirk. Therefore, you know, we're going to invent our own wheel, and our wheel will be rounder than their wheel. So, and it was sort of frustrating because we had all these other editors. Another thing you're seeing with a lot of modern operating systems is sort of the App Store model, right? Macs have App Stores now, Windows 8 has App Stores, Google Android, Chrome OS have App Stores. And in terms of software updates, this is another way that development companies are able to abstract having to deal with the update problem, right? I don't have to write an updater for Android. I just provide them my new version. They put it on the market. Their updater will install it on the Android platform. Great, right? Like I don't have to actually think about it. As a developer, I just make my application later so that they figure out how to install this update. And we thought that model was actually kind of cool because, like I said, we had all these other applications at Adobe where they all have their own sort of update thing, right? Where Dreamweaver and Photoshop had different updaters because they both wanted to create their own wheel. Or you know, Dreamweaver came from Macmedia, whereas Photoshop came from Adobe. So they both had different updaters when they started in different organizations before merged and stuff like that. But we started this business model of the Creative Cloud. And if you know Adobe, we have what was known as the Creative Suite. The Creative Suite was all of your content editing and authoring applications that Adobe makes. Your Photoshops, your Dreamweavers, Illustrator, InDesign, Edition, video editing software, all that sort of stuff. It was all part of the Creative Suite. You go to our website, you give us like $1,600, you download all the applications. But Adobe wanted to move that business model for the Creative Suite. And we followed the App Store model. We generated a unified updater where you can go, you can see all the applications that you currently have installed. It'll tell you whether they're up to date. And then you can see all the other applications that are available in the Creative Suite. Choose to install them. So, like this sort of looks like the Google Play interface. If you've ever gone and looked at your apps in Google Play, right? It lists all of them, it'll tell you which ones are up to date or not. Then they're always trying to get you down to more apps. And for the end user, this is actually nicer because they had one updater they have to deal with. It tells them whether or not they're all up to date. And it shows them other stuff that they want to install if they ever created a cloud subscription. So we actually sort of borrowed that model for the Creative Cloud. But we didn't forget enterprises. You can actually take that updater and you can run it as a command line. So if you have some group policy, and you want to manage the, all of your Photoshop installations, your Pixar or something like that, just like that, everyone's more than you can create your policy, run the command line to invoke the application manager, and we'll talk to Adobe servers. Or if you're the type of environment where maybe you don't allow running out to the internet, you have to bring all the packages in-house. What we like to do is you run a web server inside of your environment. That web server will go and pull down all the updates from the Adobe site so you can store them locally. And then you can have the command line auto-update tool talk to your internal server rather than Adobe server. That's how you can get the updates to all the desktops in your environment. So that they're actually checking the updates there inside your network rather than talking directly to Adobe sites. And enterprises like this, they're always scared of like the operating network. Yeah. We'd rather download it ourselves, take a look at it. Once we confirm it's saved, we'll distribute it. Or once we confirm that the update won't break existing workflow, we'll distribute it. So we never try to bid out the enterprises when we do our update models. And the other thing that's happening in a lot of organizations, just from the business side, is update cycles are increasing. And this is for different reasons. One is sort of the rise of software as a service models where you have Office 360 and Google Docs and stuff like that. Before, when everything was desktop software and you had to go to the store and buy it, you could do the waterfall development model where you update and create updates like once a year, ship new boxes and stuff like that. With software as a service can update any day in one. Most software as a service websites will actually update multiple times a day. Like Facebook. It was either Facebook or Cengage was like updating their website 20 times a day. Right? So they can do updates all day long. As soon as the piece of code is ready, it goes out the door. Right? So people who create desktop software have to keep up with this, and therefore they're increasing their update strategies. So you know, if we look at web desktop software, this is especially true, because they're trying to keep up with all the innovation in HTML5. Right? New standards are coming out with HTML5 all the time, therefore you have to keep up. And make sure that your end is supporting all this stuff. So, Flash Player, who's currently is updated once a month. Chrome updates once every 6 weeks. Firefox updates once every 6 weeks. The organizational model for shipping updates is becoming much faster. So, when you're thinking about your software updates, you have to think about how are they going to impact the company's ability to ship stuff faster. Because that may be a selling point for your organization. Is it a streamlined tool where I can create a package update and ask customers minimal process? Right? So Adobe, we're trying to ship security updates within 14 days, therefore the update is there. Right? And everything inside the organization is changing to meet this. You always have to have a shippable branch ready, you've got to be able to certify our builds, so we get them out, the external communication, coming up with all that sort of stuff, considering the impacts of downstream customers. And shift updates, something goes wrong. Internal answer. Tons of automation. You're going to be able to ship all those different versions of the DLL and all those different distribution panels, so you have to automate. And then, as part of that, because you're shipping so quickly, you also have to have response plans for when it goes wrong. Can you shut down the update system? Can you roll it back? Can you, what's going to happen if we start to ship an update out, you know, to 600 million users in 48 hours, and then we find out there's a bug. 12 hours in. You know, stop, they have to roll back. And that's a concern of organizations when they're looking at updates. How are we going to be able to handle that condition with our update process? So that's something to think about when you're designing updates. And the last thing I'll probably I'm going to talk about is. Within Adobe, I've had to encourage teams to improve their auto-update systems. One of the things I have to do is I can give you a security patch to people faster. But that doesn't always mean that security alone is enough to explain the benefits to organizations, right? Or like a differential updater. Yeah, a differential updater will reduce costs. Well, let's say I've got one developer. I can have a differential updater that reduces costs, right? Or I can have that same developer work on a feature that brings in more revenue. And has the added bonus of making a customer happy. If I'm trying to decide between the two tasks that I'm going to have to develop for you, the differential updater may not be at the top of the list. Even though it would reduce business costs, there's managers are always making decisions about what's the opportunity cost that has to know. What could I be pursuing in terms of new features and making the customer happy? go back and do this maintenance work. So it's sort of important to understand, like, business drivers of the adoption, how the tools that you guys are creating are going to fit into the model of actually it shifts. Because no business ever actually shifts the technology solely because it's cool, right? Maybe some, like, Google R&D labs can have something like that. No one ever pays attention to it. But a lot of organizations, that, you know, you're on budget, you're on time scale, you know, from apps, all that sort of stuff. So you want to be able to describe the benefits to different groups and explain to different groups how your engineers can be able to solve it, solve their issues. And depending on who you're talking to, you may need to be able to sell to different audiences. So, like with the Creative Cloud team, the thing that made them finally solve the everybody has their own update code, it was actually a business need. It wasn't like a sandy need of like dealing with the fact that everybody has their own update. It was a business need. The business need was basically, if you have a waterfall development model, your revenue is also sort of a side thing. You release something new, you get a bunch, you know, your revenue goes up because everybody's buying a new thing. And then you announce that the next version is going to come out, and everybody stops buying because they're waiting for the next version. Right? So as a company, you're rich, and then you're poor, and then you're rich, and then you're poor. And it's a hard way to run a business, right? You want a steady revenue stream. So with Creative Cloud, what they did is they went to software as a service, form of software as a service and all. Still desktop software, you still install it, and you pay a monthly subscription. And then one of the advantages of that is it removed a different restriction we have, which is when you're on that waterfall model, you can only ship updates once a year. Right? So if I'm the Photoshop team and I've got the latest, greatest photo editing thing that allows you to remove your access from all of your photos, which we do actually have a feature that does that, you would have to sit on your hands and wait for all the other development teams to catch up with what they're doing, and then you would all ship them. And if you're dealing with like trying to keep up with all the other code and software, that's hard, right? So your competition's gonna get ahead of you, all that sort of stuff. So by going to a subscription-based model, what that allowed them to do is people can just go out whenever they're ready, as opposed to waiting for the next, you know, big bucket release where you go and pay $1,600 a bucket. You just pay the subscription model, then we just ship the features whenever you need. So being able to improve, you know, revenue control was a reason to improve our update system so that we could be able to do the sort of software as a service model, desktop software. You need to be able to sell, like, how does it improve the business? Yes, your differential updater is cool, but how does that actually make things better? Right? And obviously, differential updaters reduce cost. But you need to be able to explain the other features. Right? The sooner customers see new features, the sooner they're happier. Get bug fixes out to them quicker, and for other reason, you know, Flash Player went into a monthly update cycle, and then he said, whenever there's a customer bug, we can fix it in 30 days as opposed to 3 months or 6 months or something like that. The allows you to keep pace with the competition. You have to be able to complete new software as a service models where they just update their website every day or something like that. So, think through some of those issues, and security is another reason that you can use to sell it. Adobe is a big target because we have such wide distribution. You can attack our software, you can hit millions of people. You know, we have to go through and like sell it from a security standpoint. One of the things from a security standpoint isn't just preventing the current attack. Yes, getting an update to the end user prevents the current attack. But the other problem is if you're slow to update, and people are slow to get your updates, you will be a more attractive target in the future. Because what the attackers are doing a cost benefit analysis in their head. It's going to cost so much to create the exploit, and then they have to look at, you know, how much work is it to create the exploit, and then how long can I use that exploit before it gets shut off. And if it takes you like 3 months or longer to actually update everybody on the web, then you're an attractive target because I can actually use that. My window's pretty big. I get a return on investment for all that work I did to create an exploit. If it's something like Chrome or Adobe or something like that, where there's growth faster around, you're going to create that 0 day, but then you're only going to be able to use it for 2 weeks. Because in 14 days, we're going to ship the update, and 2 days after that, we'll have updated that. So you're only getting like 2 weeks as soon as you get the tech. So you don't get as much return on investment for creating an exploit. The other thing that you need to be able to deal with is a zero-day attack rarely occurs at any time to ship. You've got notified the day we ship something. It's like, yay, we ship something. No, here's a zero-day. We have to ship again. Right? Never ignore the enterprise. Like, it always seems weird that enterprises try to, like, why don't you see Chrome sign with an updater? Why are you trying to prevent people from getting updates for the sake of it? But they do have their reasons, they are valid, and kind of time to go up the wall here. Always think about the enterprise. Because a large software vendor, especially when your software used by a large software vendor, we have to care about these people because they're usually very exposed to revenue. So always keep in mind, like, how can I do the enterprise installation? Sort of like what we did with the Creative Cloud stuff, where, yeah, you have a centralized management, you have GUI, it looks like app stores, people will understand it because it looks like all the other app stores. But also, you know, still create this server so you can those environments. And then also, sounds like this also reduce customer fatigue. If you search I would not encourage you to go onto Twitter and search the place to flash and update because we'll see some non safe for work comments about flash updates on Twitter, but people will be annoyed about it. But there's like PR benefits, being able to get to those sound updates and then you reduce customer. Less of those Twitter comments now that we do with sound updates. They're warning with every update. Like, thank you for installing. Please retrieve your machine. Right? And everybody gets excited to stop whatever they're doing to deal with that. So understand the role of the software as you're placing your environment. It will make things much happier. So to close things out, not only updates and software updates, it's a technological challenge. How do we do it? In the differential updater world, there's a digital signature attached to the binary. We've got to make sure that the digital signature not only updates the code, but also updates the digital signature for that binary at the same time. You can't update one without the other, so you have to go through all these technological challenges. How do you update 600 million users without prying the internet back up? They're definitely a security challenge. You've got to be able to get software updates to customers faster. Hackers are increasing in numbers. We have to improve our response time for it. There's tenfold more hackers now in the environment than there was when I first started the industry. It's an operational challenge. You know, how do you do software as a service? How do you have a software updater work with our accelerated models? It's a business challenge, right? Can it help us increase revenue, increase steady revenue? What is this going to do to the business better? Those are all things you have to be able to think about and settle in your larger organization trying to build updaters. So know how they benefit. If you're going to sell the technology to someone, make sure you understand how they benefit both the business and the customers. As you're designing your code, be aware that it's going to be the target attackers. You know, if I can do a buffer overflow in your client-side update technology, to take control of the machine. It's one more way into the environment. And sort of think through those things. Like I said, the news stories that I posted earlier, I didn't stop because I ran out of news stories. I stopped because I ran out of room on the slide. Take that consideration. The third thing that's why is create good update workflows that you can create. Something that's simple for developers to use, whether it's like an update for the Java runtime environment, maybe, where people don't have to write their update code, they just use your develop package thing. Or it's a silent updater. They do have a lot of that just for organizations. And they definitely fit one of the goals that I've been trying to do. If you have questions about any of the stuff I talked about, you can find me on Twitter. We have a blog from the security team. We talk about the updaters there. If you want information on how our updaters work, and you have references to the different updaters, where we describe, in Windows we use a task scheduler, on Mac we use craft the name of the data, and we use the Mac to check our progress. But we've actually documented a lot of the stuff that we've done for the different installers. So if you have questions or if you want references to more in depth into how we've actually implemented these. feel free to reach out to me. I can get back to them at least to document it. So that'll take any questions. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so just out of historical curiosity, Macromedia, before Adobe swallowed it, was one of the earliest companies to be looking at App Store models and stuff historically in like late 90s even. So has any of that fed into this, or is just did you independently do that?
We still definitely have a number of people who work at Macromedia. On your organization, the director of my group is a Macromedia employee. Adobe has pretty good research. Yeah, I think at least three people on my team were originally Macromedia employees after the Adobe acquisition. The Adobe acquisition was 2006, something like that. So we definitely saw a lot of that mindset around in terms of thinking about things. If I were to hazard a guess, I would say it's probably more the adoption that the other people have done in the markets. And we were looking at a way to give the user a familiar experience, right? Something that they would be used to. Because, like I said, the user is just the simplest thing possible. So we could create our own UI with some special stuff. Or like, yeah, we can sort of look like we can deal with the App Store. Going forward, especially as people are going to start to migrate from the same and you know, Mac OS is going to continue to work in their app stores. So going with them all in a certain sense in terms of that's what the future is going to look like. Yes?
Security question. So my organization and the organization I was at before lived with expired certificates. So whenever I logged into an internal website, I'd get the error message from the browser, and
right.
You know, do you want to proceed and all that kind of stuff. Do you see replacements for the certificate model on the horizon at all?
I see people trying to make the model work better. So one of the things that like Firefox is doing is like one type of certificate error is the idea of mixed content. Right? If you have a web page, some of the links are going to HTTPS, and some of the links are going to HTTP. And when you have mixed content where you're pulling trusted and untrusted stuff together, the browser assumes it's all untrusted because it only takes one untrusted thing to ruin the security of everything that you download the rest of the cell. So they're being more aggressive in terms of going after that sort of stuff. I would expect CAs and operating systems are probably going to get better about validating and giving people stricter warnings now that it's becoming a bigger issue. So it's okay if certificates expire as long as the code is signed before the expiration of that certificate. Right? And so one of the things you do when you sign code is the timestamp in there. That way, if the certificate is out of date, you check the timestamp when it was signed. And if it was signed before the certificate went out of date, you're still good to go. Right? So if you had a signed version of Atari Pac-Man from 1984 or something, you can still play it today because chances are they signed it before the certificate expired. It's also signed before it expired. There's room for improvement in terms of how the CAs revoke certificates. And there's room for improvement on how the operating systems deal with stuff. Like on Windows won't actually block you from installing stuff unless you put the certificate in the untrusted store. So if you know Internet Explorer, you go to security settings, there's a place where you put certificates, that's where you put your personal certificates and stuff like that. And what you know, so you gotta tap the personal certificates, you gotta tap the CA certificates that are installed in the browser, and then there's another tab for untrusted. And if someone puts the certificate in the untrusted store, the operating system blocks you completely from installing it. If the certificate is wrote via CRL, via VeriSign or bot or something like that, creating a certificate revocation list and letting your certificate broken, the list of revoked certificates, the operating system will give you a scarier file log, but it will still allow you to install. You can still click through and say, no, just I don't care, just install. Trying to get my work done, install, right? On Mac has been moving towards Gatekeeper, where you have Gatekeeper certificates, things like that. And so like Adobe now signs all our Macs all the Gatekeeper certificates. And that's allowing them to have a little bit more control over sign code within the Mac operating system. But if you install something outside of Gatekeeper, the only way you can tell what the certificates revoked is there's I forget the name of the command line. You run it's like search utilities or something like that. You have to run the command lines to check the validity of the images and sure the app is installed. Otherwise, Mac is sort of close enough. So I would expect you'll probably see Mac operating system, the Apple guys starting to leverage Gatekeeper, where they're going with Gatekeeper in the App Store. As a way to serve that market. So I think that too much of the industry is embedded in this design model for them to turn shit on that, especially when there's room for improvement. So I would expect what's more likely to happen is the industry will be more strict about stuff moving forward. And then, eventually we may have like the HTML5 of digital certificates for serving that. For now,
and my guess is the IT folks just don't want to pay for it.
Well, the IT folks will do whatever makes their life simpler. So, converting to a new model will be slow with IT folks because then you can't program the all the operating systems. Right? Windows 8 in an enterprise environment will be very slow to distribute because you have to retrain everybody. Enterprises aren't going to deal with that. But if it reduces their workload, it reduces the number of like malware responses they have to do and all that sort of stuff, they will eventually be doing this. They're still motivated to make their lives simpler and their days shorter, just like everybody else. So, I think if it works, the IT people would pick it up. I think it would be slow because it's stuff
like that. But they would have been better. Any other questions? Sure. So on mobile devices, it's like there's tons and tons of updates on software. And I think part of the reason is that the way you have to design your apps on the like almost has to support updates because you have to be able to sort of kill your app when you switch away from it and restart it and reload against memory. So when you went to this cloud model for the creative suite, do you see that affecting the way those apps are built, that now that there are updates that can come out more frequently, do they have some of those attributes? So for example, if you're in the middle of Photoshop and an update comes up, can you just like install the update, kind of kills and restarts, and like everything comes back where it was before? Or are they still more in the desktop model of you just shut it down and you come from scratch each time? Where does that affect things at all?
It has. The first generation of it was still basically a button for downloading the installer and everything worked as it did before. It was and it's time for you to do that. But some of the practices are moving. Workflow going, allowing things to restart. The biggest thing I see with mobile applications, like one of the challenges we had with the Android App Store and Flash Player, was when we were doing the big Flash Android push, by default the app is not set to auto-update. And as a user, you can go into the App Store and you can say, no, just go ahead and update it whenever it's available or proper, just do it. And Android will do it, but that's something the user has to choose and won't actually update. It won't allow the app to say, make me another update app. And it won't, that won't happen unless the user goes in and like changes their settings. Or go ahead and change their settings. He does that. I don't know if that's true for the most recent version of Play. My personal Android phone is Android, right? So it's a whole parish of that. But that was part of the gas of like our update levels. Because some of those version numbers reflected mobile devices. And so chances are the version of the platform you have is whichever version of the manufacturer installed. Right? Or whichever one you downloaded when you signed one of the platform developers. Maybe you go and update, you know, pay attention to the play updates. That was one of the challenges to get people. Especially on mobile devices, in the early days of mobile devices, being able to ship updates was really important because one of the technological challenges of Flash Mobile was the fact that you had all these different manufacturers creating mobile devices. They all have different chipsets. And one of the main features of Flash is that it processes video really well. It's what lets YouTube. So you want to be able to do GPU acceleration. But all these different manufacturers all have different GPUs, depending on, you know, how much they invested in the phone and, you know, expensive model or cheap model and stuff like that. So when we're designing the Android updater, part of what we had to do was notify the Play Store that update was available, and then also have this like version check thing. Your list of like, okay, it's a Motorola Atrix, you go here, but if it's a Samsung Galaxy, you get this update, this Nook, Barnes & Noble Nook, you get this update. Because they all have different hardware, different chipsets, different GPUs. So one of the challenges was that we had to have hardware-specific updates, which added to the complexity of having just version updates, just on hardware-specific updates. And you know, you have to go through the security analysis of like, how do you make sure that they get the right one, and, you know, they've got to be checked over SSL, all that sort of stuff. So that was also an additional thing. So for a lot of Android apps, like a lot, if you're a small business, create like a Hello World Android app, just enough so that you can say you have one and more modern and hip. But if you're like, you only install the app and it's got like two tabs, this is a bus code. Yeah. But if you're trying to do something advanced, if you're trying to be Flash Player, or trying to be a Hulu app, or trying to be anything that takes advantage of the hardware, or screen sizes, they all have different screen sizes. How do you scale your apps and fit all different little tiny ones, and then you've got a big pocket ones, which are red, and then you've got an actual ones that hook up to a TV screen, so you have to be able to get TV resolution. So one of the challenges in the mobile environment is being able to develop all that if you're doing something more advanced than just rudimentary stuff. Or like game developers who are a primary audience, they want to take advantage of all this. They see it's gotta be quick, but you can't have like little power glasses sticking in the middle of your game, otherwise you'll throw their phone through the window. Being able to track all that was one of the challenges. Either that or you have a really large update with a bunch of pounding apps for different environments, which is also not optimal because it's going to take them, you know, charge $20 in data services every time they update your app. So mobile devices were actually a challenge for us because we were trying to do hardware specific stuff. It's just all of them. And we kind of, it was a challenge to keep up with all the different chipsets that are out there in the market. Like right now, my personal Linux server is a mini PC. So basically, it's like a USB device. And they call them like mini TVs. It's a little hardware device up, 8x8, runs on 5 watts, and runs Android. And you can set up dual boot and two boot. And I got tired of the fan noise on my desktop. So I replaced it with a little. That's that big. And now I have a Linux server that's 5 watts, it's that big, so you're on the TV, you can't even see it. But because, you know, but that might be one of the Android devices that you're shipping to, is a little Android mini TV, which has HDMI out to my monitor. So you want to have like HDMI, you want to be able to have your app work on the HDMI screen, that's the whole monitor size, in addition to like the little phone. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Could you talk about how you assign release numbers? I mean, you went from, you know, hundreds down to...
Take 20 cents die. No, actually, part of it was just getting everything in sync. So part of the reason why we had different version numbers is it was based on the build. It was based on the build number. Every time you update the code, you have to build number. And because we had to deal with different updates, cycles for different things, so it was possible that we would ship an update solely for Android. So the Android version number, we got to increment the build number for Android to handle those hardware problems we talked about, but we were going to update the desktop software. So you'd have Android on one version number, and then you would have the normal desktop flashbacks on the version number. And at the same time, we were working on doing the integration with Chrome. And getting FlashBerry running in a security sandbox and be integrated into Chrome. And in the early days of the Chrome integration, we started shipping it as integrated Chrome before we had all the bugger, before we had all the issues. So for the sandbox, basically, we use limited what processing you do. You intentionally limit your own privileges so that if you exploit my code, you take control of my DLL. Maybe a level doesn't have a lot of privileges, so you can't go over it anymore. So, before, FlashBerry would run with whatever privileges the user was, and some systems that user had. Right? So, if you put yourself in a sandbox, you can say, yeah, that's fine that you're admin, but I don't want to be an admin, I don't want to be responsible for having admin privileges, so I'm going to downgrade the privileges in my process so that I don't have those. That's sort of what a sandbox is. But the problem with doing that is you have to create brokers to handle all the privilege requests that you still have to make. So, calls to the printer, you have to access the device driver, and then so we're doing pretty fast iterations on the Chrome versions because they're bugs, and we're dealing with sandbox. So, Chrome would be incremented. We have different build numbers for the Chrome versions. Today, things have sort of evened out where we're now in the rapid fire of Android. Chrome is stable. Windows 8 is stable. So then it's rare that you have to do an update for a specific platform. If you have version numbers, that's a specific platform. So that's what helped us consolidate.
So what I heard you say is that the reason you don't have so many version numbers anymore is that you stopped making, you no longer have the necessity to make a version specific or platform-specific kinds of versions.
Right. We still do from time to time for various reasons, but it's not. During that time that chart was going on, everything was on fire. Chrome was off on its doing its stuff. Android was doing its stuff. And there were just versions everywhere.
I was hopeful you had a nice, clever procedure that people
could apply. No, we just unified our development model, and those things sort of stabilized itself. Now we just do one update for everyone. There's still a little bit of that. We haven't really eliminated it, but it's less than before. So for instance, if there was a vulnerability that targeted specifically Android, we might implement Android without updating everybody at the desktop environment. Why would people do that thing they need to? Anything else? Yeah.
So you have two types of updates, in my opinion. The security updates, which you want to ship out really, really fast, as in yesterday, and the feature-rich updates, which you don't want to disturb the client, the end user, you want to ship them as polished as possible, right? Have you ever considered treating these two fundamentally different?
Yes. We have, and sometimes we do. So we have, like I said, we have different update channels so that we want to do. So everybody knows what silent update is. If you're actually prompting the user with like, hey, there's an update there, we call that a loud release because it's the opposite of silent. So there, in FlashBerry, for instance, we maintain both update channels. We do the silent, like hurry up and get it installed, or if we have to prompt the user for whatever reason. We can still ship the loud updates. The loud updates aren't going to have the same adoption because of a couple of reasons.
one, just because people will choose more to do it. The original Lava Theater was based on needing to reboot the machine for the long time we needed the LLs in the use. We fixed some of that, but still, the check rate isn't quite the same. So we do treat them fundamentally. We kept both options open to us because we needed both options. And also, sound, you know, occupied bills are peaks. So we have, so it's not all okay, it's more expensive, of course, it's huge piece of that. So if we don't have to do the rush, you know, we may be allowed to control the game. So usually that might build in the direct enforcement. You know, it could be one of the reasons why we do it. So yes, yeah, so we do maintain both our channels so that we have a choice of how aggressively we're going to just have some people work. It's more likely to be a cause is, you know, if it's going to be a significant change and it may break some overflow, we might do a lot of it just so that they will be aware that their system changed and they'll be able to go, oh, they probably broke this by that update. Then they call tech support to report the bug and they can say, I applied your update to the other and it stopped. Whereas with the sign model update, everything just stops working. Right. So that's another reason to keep it. We think it's going to be a fundamental change. We may want to do it loud, but it's just that it's easier for us to debug and things. So, does that answer your question?
I see that even as a different driver, it's part of the sound updates. So the sound updates, you're not going to break anything.
Right.
And at the same time, it looks like if you attempt to apply a silent update on the fly, for instance, you can't take this offline.
Yeah, you're correct. Like there, we also envisioned a scenario where we have to do both simultaneously. Where, you know, what's, because you think through all the worst case scenarios. One of the worst case scenarios is you want to, you've got an update that, let's say, changes the UI, so you have to update. You have to do the prompts because people have to agree to leave you alone before you actually change their desktop. But at the same time, you have a security vulnerability. So we would have to do two separate builds. We would have to push the older build on the silent update channel. We have to push the loud update on the loud channel. And loud updater needs to be able to deal with the fact that the silent auto updater may or may not have picked in. Sound up, follow up here, we have to deal with the fact that the validator beat it so much, so I need to make sure that the new version check will, oh, I'm actually not going to use something, so I would move down grade, you know, move down grade. We kept the possibility open that we may have to push both of these extra time, as worst case scenario. And, down grade is actually
all right, why don't we thank Paul for having us.